Okay, well, for the last few weeks, we've actually looked at the opening of the first four seals. We find this in Revelation 6, verses 1 through 8. We've looked at the various details of the four colored horses, as well as the riders on those horses. And today we're going to consider what the significance of the seals are, and not just the four seals that we've looked at, but hopefully this will kind of set the stage for the rest of the seals that we'll be looking at when it comes to the book of Revelation. What I'm going to share this morning is really the understanding that I have come to when it comes to the study of these seals, and it may or may not be everyone's understanding, and that's certainly okay. But I think that as I have studied this and have really kind of delved into, you know, not just paragraph by paragraph, but verse by verse and even word by word, going through the exegesis of this, the understanding that I've come to and then really was supported by some of the writers that I've learned from over the course of the last several months as well. But I think that as we take the text as written, hopefully this will make more sense as far as the placement and the role of the sealed judgments, which we find starting Revelation 6. And if you remember, we actually go until the first few verses of Revelation chapter 8 with that first interlude, that first close-up that we come to. So the first thing we're going to consider this morning is what we can call the function of the seals. The function of the seals, and especially the first four seals, because that's where we spent most of our time studying and looking at already. Of course, when Jesus opened the first seal in verses 1 and 2, John saw a white horse, right? In fact, why don't we read those verses together? Revelation 6, 1 and 2. And I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard, as it were, the noise of thunder, one of the four beasts saying, come and see, or come if it's directed directly to the horse and rider. Verse 2, and I saw, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat on him had a bow, and a crown was given unto him, and he went forth conquering and to conquer. And so when John sees this white horse, the rider also comes with him from heaven to earth, and if you remember, that was on a mission of conquest, right? Mission of conquest. And that can be seen in either a positive way or a negative way. And there are certainly people that hold to either one. Then we come to verses 3 and 4. Jesus opens the second seal. And when he saw a red horse, verse 3, he opened the second seal. I heard the second beast say, come and see. And there went out another horse that was red. And power was given to him that sat thereon to take peace from the earth, and that they should kill one another. And there was given unto him a great sword. And if you remember, the mission of the second seal is the mission of conflict, right? And that conflict can take place on many levels, certainly on national level, could also be within a nation. There are many who think this just describes civil warfare. But, of course, along with civil warfare is going to come community conflict, as well as even interpersonal conflict and even conflict within families. So this is all kinds of conflict that is the mission of this force and this spiritual force. Then we come to the third seal in verses 5 and 6. It says, when he, the Lamb, Jesus, had opened the third seal, I heard the third beast, living one, say, come and see. And I beheld, and lo, a black horse. And he that sat on him had a pair of balances in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts say, a measure of wheat for a penny, and three measures of barley for a penny, and see thou hurt not the oil and the wine. And of course, we can describe this as a mission over commerce. And because it is dealing with commercial things, and especially the wants and needs of men, both those things that are essential and even non-essentials. The essentials, of course, are the wheat and the barley. The non-essentials would be the oil and the wine. In many ways, this would be either forced or self-imposed famine. If it's top-down approach, you know, the price fixing and all of those things and withholding what is needed for the people, that's certainly one way it can result. Or if it's a self-imposed famine, the people are more interested in the non-essentials of life than the essentials. And we talked about how, you know, you can go without food, but you got to have that cell phone in your pocket. Certainly that's something that we see even today. But then we come to the fourth seal, and we spent most of our time looking at this last week, verses 7 and 8. When he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth beast say, come and see. And I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and his name that sat on him was Death, and hell followed with him. And power was given unto them over the fourth part of the earth to kill with sword and with hunger and with death, where the beasts of the earth. And of course, that is where we ended looking at the four seals. But if you remember this pale horse, the rider is unique from all the rest. We saw some of those unique features last week. It may be described as hovering instead of sitting on this horse. It's a different preposition dealing with how it is related to this horse. This particular rider also has a name, whereas the others do not have a name given to them. The name of this rider is Death. And the other unique feature is that this particular rider has a partner. And that partner is also Hell, or Hades. And together, Hell and Death and Hell, go on forth a mission of what we describe as carnage upon the fourth part of the earth. Now, one of the things that we looked at concerning that phrase and really the different fractions that we come to in the book of Revelation is that they're very precise, they're very specific, and so to have a mission of carnage upon the fourth of the earth does not necessarily mean a quarter of the population of the earth will die at any specific time, but it simply means that his mission is limited to a quarter of the earth at a time. And so there's this function of death. If you can actually look at and see how many people have actually died roughly in the world any time of year. I think it was last year, some 67 million people all throughout the world have died. And so really, the mission of carnage is ongoing. And I think back around the time when John was probably writing this, I think the estimate might have been about 300 million people alive at this time. So it was fairly low population, and the population certainly has grown exponentially, even in the last 200 years. But 67 million people is a lot, especially if you think back in the time when this was written. I mean, millions upon millions of people are dying every single day on this earth. And of course, there's different means of that death as well. What we found there in verse 8 were also the four instruments that death and hell will use to accomplish their mission. We have the instrument of war there in verse 8, which is the sword. We have the instrument of want, which is the instrument of hunger or famine. It's also translated there in Revelation. The instrument of woes. This could be really any other means of death besides sword and famine. It could include disease and pestilence, or even natural disasters, as we'll see here shortly. But also with the instrument of what we just said is wrongs, the wrongs that are committed against God, against people by the beasts of the earth. Throughout Revelation, beasts of the earth, and just really any beast, does not refer to an animal, but rather to men who act like beasts in their rebellion to God, their opposition to man, and their persecution of God's people. So that's all review of these four horses with their horsemen and the four instruments that are used by death and hell. We already learned that the background for these four horses and these four horsemen is back in Zechariah chapter 6. We looked at that when we first started looking at the four seals. And there are four kinds of horses also in Zechariah that work together to accomplish God's purpose of judgment on the earth. And I think as we have looked at these four horsemen, we can probably see these four horses and their riders in a similar way. They are sent into the world, one right after the other, in this vision, and they actually can function together. And so you kind of see the brackets here. They function together, so they go to and fro through the earth to accomplish their missions. And I think that's one of the reasons why Zechariah 6 is brought into here in Revelation, is because it's showing really not four separate missions, but one mission. One mission that is approached from different angles. In fact, in Zechariah, the horses and their chariots go to the different compass points of the earth. And certainly that might be intended here as well. But they function together here just like they did there. And one reason to see these four seals as functioning together is through the four instruments that we've already looked at. The four instruments that death and hell use to kill. Because if you remember, the first instrument of death is a sword. And it's parallel to the sword that is given to the rider on the red horse in the second seal. And so if you kind of look at verse 8, and you can even see that the means by which death and hell are going to use to kill, we have sort of a repetition of some of the previous seals here as well. So if you look at the first instrument that is mentioned there, to kill with sword, and then you jump down to verse 4, and we have the red horse, and the rider was given to him, it was given to him to take peace from the earth, because there was given unto him a great, what? A great sword. And so the instrument of the sword is parallel to the red horse in the second seal. And you can actually trace this going down through the instruments. The second instrument of death is what? Hunger, right? Hunger and famine. And this is parallel to the poverty that will take place under the auspices of the rider of the black horse. You know, so if you go back to verse 6, or verses 5 and 6, we find the black horse, he that had that sat on him had a pair of balances in hand, and I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts say, a measure of wheat for a penny. And obviously there's want there. There's a lack of food there, which would lead to, again, famine, whether it's imposed from above or self-imposed from beneath. And so we see the parallel of the second instrument of death, hunger and famine, related to the rider of the black horse. Of course, the third instrument of death is death, and that is certainly related to the pale horse of the fourth seal, because he is able to do what his name implies. Death uses death to kill. And basically, he's using different means of death besides sword, besides famine. And so this would include diseases as well as natural ways of death. And we'll see that here in a little bit later. But then we come to that fourth instrument of death, and that is those wild beasts. Again, there in verse 8. So we've got the sword related to the second seal, hunger related to the third seal, death related to the fourth seal. So where does this beast of the earth come in? Well, if we look at beasts not as animals, but beasts as men who act like animals, this would parallel the first seal and its rider on the white horse, especially if the first rider will use beasts of the earth in his mission of conquest. And again, these are human beasts. You can even call these antichrists. And that's why as we were going through these seals, I take it as a negative way, referring to the first seal, especially dealing with the spirit of antichrists. John describes how not only will there be a antichrist in the future, the antichrist, but even says there are many antichrists since the time of Jesus, and really even before the time of Jesus. And so these human beasts, these human antichrists, will try to conquest hearts and lives through different ways. One of those ways is intimidation. And if we think back, even just within the some of the lifetimes of, let's say, our brother Andy, right? You think about Adolf Hitler. He certainly was an antichrist, but he was an antichrist through intimidation, and many lives were lost because of him. He certainly sought to conquest not just his own people, but pretty much world as he could possibly get, all right? But there's also antichrists that try their conquest in different ways through imitation of Christ. Especially during the time of the Reformation, the Roman Catholic Church, and especially the Pope, were seen as antichrist because they were putting themselves in the place of Christ. And so instead of coming to God through Christ alone, they would say, no, you have to come through the church because the Pope is the vicar of Christ. The Pope is Christ's representative on this earth instead of the Holy Spirit, which is truly the representative of Christ. And so, again, the goal of these human beasts is to keep as many souls as they can captive to the dominion of the dragon or the devil, who we will see elsewhere. And so again, you see the parallels between these four instruments of death and the four seals themselves. And really, many believe that these four instruments will summarize in different ways all four seals working together to accomplish their ultimate goal. And one of the reasons why you have the beast of the earth related to the first seal, that is, the last instrument of death related to the very first seal, is because of a literary device that you find all throughout the Bible known as an inclusio. It's just a Latin word that means to include something. And that's one of the reasons why I have those brackets on either side, right? Because a lot of times you're going to come to a list and you're going to find something at the very beginning and something at the very end that will sort of be bookends to show that it's all included. If you go into the office, at the very top of the office bookshelf, I had to use that top part for books as well. But you'll notice that there are bookends. And I don't remember exactly what they are. They were here when we got here, so they've been here a long time. I don't know who bought them or who got them. They probably belonged to Phil Aguilar a long time ago. But if you really want to know what section of books belongs to someone, a lot of times you're going to have bookends. You got the one on the left and the one on the right, and they have all of the books in between. And that's kind of what an inclusio does. So here we have the first seal, this rider coming to conquer, and then the last instrument of death, which is the beast of the earth. And as they correspond with each other, as they parallel each other, it shows that all four of those function together to do their work of judgment here on this earth. So the instruments of death that we find in the fourth seal can summarize all the different ways that the four seals work together to accomplish their ultimate goal. So we can see all four seals, and this is certainly what I hold, is that they function as a unit. And the other reason why we look at it this way is because in Zechariah, they function as a unit. You know, they come one right after the other in Zechariah, but then as they're out there, they're all four riding throughout the earth doing their work together. And I think that's what's happening here as well when it comes to these four horsemen and riders. They're never recalled. They continue to do their working as they ride throughout the world. Their missions are more general in nature than the specific ones that you find in the trumpets and the bowls. I remember the fractions. When you talk about the fractions of the trumpets, you're talking about a third of the earth, a third of the water, a third of mankind, a third of these things. Well, this is talking about the fourth part of the earth and its global and its geographic sense. And so we can see general judgments that are ongoing before those specific judgments take place in the trumpets and the bowls. So as long as these horses and their riders are in this world, they continue to wreak their havoc in this world. But again, the big question is when will they do this and for how long? Well, I believe we can answer this by looking next at the fulfillment of the seals. The fulfillment of the seals. So if we look at them working together to accomplish God's purpose for these forces in this world at any one time, we can see the fulfillment of the seals because I do believe we've seen these seals already in our study of Revelation or our study in eschatology, especially in Jesus' Olivet Discourse. So we see parallels, again, between the four instruments of death with the four horsemen and riders. But we also see parallels with all seven of these seals with Matthew chapter 24. So keep your finger here in Revelation 6. You may want to go back and forth. But go with me to Matthew chapter 24. As we turn there, let's try to remember some of the things that we've learned already from Revelation chapter 6. Of course, it's been a little while since we've been through Matthew 24. But not only does Jesus tell his disciples about the distant future of the distant future and his return from heaven, which, again, part of Matthew 24 deals with, he also tells them about their imminent future, even after his return home to heaven. So, again, Matthew 24 talks about what's going to happen between the time of his departure to heaven and his return from heaven. And more specifically, he actually talks about what's going to happen in between the fall of Jerusalem and before his return from heaven. Because if you look at verse 1 of Matthew 24, just to kind of set the stage where we've been before, Jesus went out, departed from the temple. His disciples came to him to show him all the buildings of the temple. And what does Jesus say? "See ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." Now, from our perspective, that's past. From their perspective, that was future. So what is Jesus referring to here? The fall and the destruction of Jerusalem. That took place in AD 70, where literally all of the stones that were on that Temple Mount were thrown over. In fact, if you look at pictures of the Temple Mount even today, they actually left a number of those huge blocks of Herodian stones, those ashlars, and they just left them where they were thrown. and just piles of them. It's remarkable how Jesus' words were precisely fulfilled in A.D. 70. And so what Jesus is going to teach them from verse 3 all the way to really verse 35 and even going on through the Olivet Discourse here, he's saying, okay, I'm going to tell you what's going to happen between the time of the fall and destruction of Jerusalem, which would have been very significant for them, and his return, which is significant for us. And so, especially from verses 4 through 14, Jesus tells them what they and we can expect things to be like in this period of time that we often call the church age. And so what's the first thing that we find? Verse 3, as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, tell us, when shall these things be? And what shall be the sign of the coming and of the end of the world? And of course, there's some multiple layers of questions there. When shall these things be refers to when those stones will be thrown down, right? What shall be the sign of thy coming? And of course, that's the return of Christ. So what's going to happen in between, which they anticipated would be the end of the world? Verse 4, Jesus answered and said unto them, take heed that no man deceive you, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. And of course, someone who says they are Christ is an antichrist, right? And certainly this antichrist is going to deceive many. Now, but he didn't just talk about one antichrist, he's talking about many antichrists, which is what John describes. There are many antichrists. And I think when we look at verses 4 and 5, this closely corresponds with what we learned about the first seal and its horse and rider in their negative sense. That is, in their mission of conquest, using those human beasts, which again is that fourth instrument of death, human beasts and antichrist in order to deceive many. And so if you look at the first seal in the negative way and consider the negative way using beasts through intimidation or imitation, we would have that here in verses 4 and 5. Now, if that's not super clear to some, we do find some more clarity when we go down to verses 6 and 7, because this also is going to take place in the period of time between the destruction of Jerusalem and Christ's return, which is the time in which we live. All right? This has been ongoing. Verse 6, and, he says, you shall hear of what? Wars and rumors of wars, right? You shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. That is, real wars and rumors of wars. See that ye be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. Again, they ask, when is the end of the world? He says, not quite yet. There's going to be wars and rumors of wars, and here's how he described it. For nation shall rise up against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. Now, if you think back to the seals, this closely aligns with the second seal and its red horse and rider, because they go out into the world on a mission of conflict. And remember, this was conflict of all kinds, especially between kingdom against kingdom and nation against nation, as Jesus says here. But there's even more alignment of these seals. If you look at verse 7, the latter part of verse 7, what does Jesus say? And there shall be famines, right? For nation shall rise up against nation, and there shall be famines. What was it about the third seal that was so significant? We have the mission over commerce, which would lead to rampant famine, right? And hunger. And so this closely aligns with what we learned in the third seal, the mission over commerce that will lead to hunger and famine. But then if you continue on there in verse 7, what else do we find? Not only will there be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in diverse manners. And we mentioned before that death, that instrument of death, that third instrument of death in Revelation chapter 6, in many places in the Old Testament, carried over into Greek, was the translation of pestilence. And this aligns closely with the fourth seal and its mission of carnage, and he can use other means of death as well. And Jesus here adds natural calamities like earthquakes, which we've already seen in Revelation is something that we see frequently. But then if you go to verse 8, what does Jesus add? All these are the beginning of sorrows. Probably a better translation is the beginning of the birth pangs, because that's the underlying word that is translated there. The beginning of birth pains. And for you women that have had children, you understand a little bit of what Jesus means, because when you're about to have that baby, right, you know that those birth pains, that those labor pains, you know, they don't start out, you know, one right after another usually. Rather, they start slowly. And then they increase in frequency and even in intensity at times, right? And to the point where, you know, you call up the doctor, they'll say, how far apart are they? And as they get closer apart, then it's time for you to get to the hospital and get things dealt with, because the baby's about to come. And that's what Jesus is saying here. This means that all the conquest and all the conflict, all the commercial inequity that would lead to famine and hunger, and all the carnage used by all of these will continue throughout time, or throughout the time in which we live, but will increase in frequency and intensity, just like a woman in labor. Now, the parallels that we have here of the first four seals and of what Jesus says in the Olivet Discourse, they're not the only parallels that we find in the seals. So this is kind of a preview of where we're going in Revelation 6. Because if you jump down to verse 9, Jesus also tells us about the progress of the gospel during this time, this period of sorrows. He says in verse 9 through 14, then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you. And you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And then shall many be offended, and shall betray one another, and shall hate one another, and many false prophets shall rise, and shall deceive many. Because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. But he that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for witness unto all nations. And then shall the end come. And clearly, the affliction and the death that we find in verse 9 is related to the sharing of the gospel in verse 14. And so what we find here in verses 9 through 14 are martyrs, right? We have Christian martyrs throughout the church age. Braden asked me on Thanksgiving Day if I have a copy of Fox's Book of Martyrs, which is really a compilation of testimonies of people who really sacrificed and laid down their life for the gospel. And of course, Jesus is saying this is going to happen to many of the apostles, and this is going to happen to many of those after the apostles. This is going to happen to many all throughout the church age. In fact, I think Brother Art was telling me that this time period in which we live is actually considered the age of martyrs. There are more martyrs today than there ever were in the history of the church. And of course, part of that is because we have the hugest population of the world than has ever been, except maybe before the flood. And so we have, just if you just look at souls being slaughtered for the sake of the gospel, this is the time in which so many martyrs, and the Fox's Book of Martyrs could be written over and over and over again because of this. Well, what happens? I told you to kind of keep your finger in Revelation chapter 6, right? So keep your finger here, go back to Revelation 6. What actually happens when Jesus opens the fifth seal? What happens when Jesus opens the fifth seal? Revelation 6, 9 through 11. What does John see? He says, I saw under the altar, Revelation 6, 9, I saw under the altar the souls of them that were what? Slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. Those are the martyrs of the church. Those are the martyrs who laid down their life for the Lord Jesus Christ. And even though in verse 10 they asked the Lord, how long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on the earth that dwell on the earth? The Lord answers in verse 11 that they should rest yet for a little season until their fellow servants also and their brethren that should be killed as they were should be fulfilled. I think that is giving us a picture of what is going to come in the interlude, the first close-up, as well as in the trumpet judgments and in the bold judgments. There are believers that are killed for their faith in the Lord and for their testimony for the Lord. So even though John sees many saints who are already slain, there are still more to be slain. So this is not talking about necessarily all of those that will be slain in the Great Tribulation. Those are yet to come. This is describing those who already were slain. And if you compare it with what Jesus said, these are the martyrs of the church that are taking place even today. Of course, this martyrdom will take place through various tribulations. If you go back to Matthew 24, We see what will happen during the Great Tribulation in verse 24. Because this, again, there will arise false Christs and false prophets and shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect. So again, this intensification will continue on with the final Antichrist and certainly with the Great Tribulation. But all throughout this age, we find many, many, many Christians giving their lives over to the Lord through their faith and testimony for Him. But then, as we continue in Matthew 24, not only do we find the fifth seal there represented, we also find in verses 29 through 30, I think when we come to verses 15, especially through, we'll say 20, 21, I think that is describing again more of what took place in AD 70. There are some who look at that as the Great Tribulation. That's fine. But when we come down to verses 29 and 30, this is anticipating the coming of Christ, right? Jesus even tells about the signs of His final return. Verse 29, immediately after the tribulation of those days. And that includes the final tribulation, that includes the final Antichrist, the final false prophet that we'll learn about in Revelation. But immediately after the tribulation of those days, so all tribulation, what's going to happen? Shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven. Keep those objects in mind. And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn. Keep that in mind. And they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven. Remember, that's the theme of Revelation. He comes with the clouds, with power and great authority. Now, if you go back to, again, keep your finger here, go back to Revelation 6 again. What does John see when Jesus opens the sixth seal? Well, if you look at verse 12 and 13, in the heavens, he sees this. And the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became as blood, and the stars of heaven fell into the earth, and even as a fig tree casteth her untimely figs when she is shaken of a mighty wind. So again, we see a parallel between this sixth seal, the objects in the heavens in the sixth seal, and the objects of heaven that John Jesus describes in the Olivet Discourse. But then John also says what he sees on earth. If you jump down to chapter 6, verses 15 through 17. And the kings of the earth, and the great men, and the rich men, and the chief captains, and the mighty men, and every bondman, and every free man, hid themselves in the dens and the rocks of the mountains. And I think Jesus succinctly describes that as all the tribes of the earth, right? And what do they say? They say to the mountains and rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of Him that sitteth on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of His wrath is come, and who shall be able to stand? And indeed, that is a mournful exclamation as you're thinking of what is yet to come when Jesus does return and pours out His final wrath upon them. But that's not all that we find in Matthew. If you go back to Matthew chapter 24, and if you look at verse 31, Jesus then talks about His final return. It says that He, Jesus, shall send His angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together His elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. If you go back to Revelation chapter 8, you don't need to turn there because I think it's right there on your lesson guide. When Jesus opens the seventh seal in Revelation 8:2, John saw not just one angel, but seven angels which stood before God, and to them were given seven trumpets. And we described how, you know, perhaps this is what he was anticipating, the final loud trumpet of God, and yet we know that there's more added, more information that's given. So you can look at how all seven seals in Revelation 6 through 8 align with the descriptions that Jesus gives us of this present age that will lead to the final return of Jesus to this earth at the sound of the last trump. And obviously there's more details that Jesus gives, and perhaps even more details that John gives to us, but they even occur in the same order. Certainly not by coincidence. Certainly there is an explanation of John, or really an interpretation in Revelation 6 through 8 of what Jesus is giving to us here in Matthew 24. And so I would consider the seven seals of Revelation describing the same things that Jesus described in His Olivet Discourse. all seven seals that relate to the time between the fall and destruction of Jerusalem and his second coming. Now, if you remember, John is writing this in the book of Revelation. All of this is still in his future. And so that doesn't change the fact that Revelation is prophecy. All right. Just like there's a lot of prophecy in the Bible that for us is past. For John, all of this was, except for what he writes in chapters 2 and 3, is yet to come. So for John, all of this was still in his future because he was given this vision about A.D. 95. So the first century is still ongoing. Jerusalem was already destroyed. All right. So the first part of the Olivet Discourse is done. The churches, chapters 2 and 3, are already dealing with issues of purity and persecution, right? Five churches were dealing with issues of purity, and two churches were dealing with issues of persecution. You know, people would say, well, I want to go back to the golden days of the church. Well, you'd have to go back even before AD 95, because that was not even the golden age, if you will, of the church. The golden age of the church is not on earth. The golden age of the church is in heaven, okay? That's when we will experience that golden age. But John himself is in exile on Patmos. In chapter 1, verse 9, for the word of God and for the testimony of Jesus Christ. And I'm sure while he's getting this vision, and or maybe for this vision, I should say, he's wondering, okay, Lord, what next? I know what you told me. I know what you, I was there on the Olivet Discourse. I heard what you said, and here's the fall of destruction. You went home to be with heaven. The destruction of Jerusalem is already done. I'm waiting for a return. So what does Jesus do? The very first thing that Jesus does is he reminds John of what he already told him would precede his coming. And so I think in chapter 6 through 8, Jesus is reminding John of what he already told them from Matthew chapter 24. And he says, it's going to be more of the same. More of the same. And so he was only seeing the beginning of the sorrows that Jesus talks about in Matthew 24. And of course, even when John was given this vision, he was living right in the middle of the time period that we call the Pax Romana, or the time of Roman peace. And so maybe it didn't seem like Matthew 24 was ongoing. You know, certainly there was persecution going on, but the conquest and the conflict and some of those other things may not have been familiar to him. And so Jesus is saying, okay, it's coming very close. All of these things will start to occur in rapid succession. And of course, in about 100 years, this Roman period of peace was basically broken. It lasted for about 200 years, about 180. And so this was, even though this was still yet in John's future, it would rapidly come. And then the beginning of sorrows. The beginning of sorrows would continue until that time of great tribulation, that time of the last final Antichrist, final false prophet, you know, final beast of the earth, which will lead to his return. Which means, from John's perspective, the worst was still to come. You know, when it talked about the church there in Smyrna, the church in Philadelphia experienced persecution. That was really just a small amount of persecution compared to what yet would come. Again, Fox's Book of Martyrs. But the worst was not only to come for God's people, but also for the world as a whole. Now, there are a couple more reasons why I think that this is perhaps the best way to look at the sealed judgments as, again, contemporary with what we're going through, at least the first five seals. I do believe that 6 and 7 are still our future. And so I mentioned a long time ago that it really kind of depends on where you draw the line between our past and our future. And I think that's probably where I would draw the line at this point. And again, there's good people that disagree with that. But I think when you compare especially what the seven seals are in Revelation 6 with what Jesus describes in Matthew 24, you know, certainly that was on purpose to be able to show to John, to remind John that this is still to come. This is still going to happen before my return. I'm not quite there yet, but persevere, because when I do come, his reward will be with him. And of course, that's what the rest of the Olivet Discourse describes as well. So ultimately, or Jesus reminds John of the plan before he reveals more of that plan to John, which will be especially in the trumpets and the bowls. So that's how I take the six seals, or the, really the seven seals of Revelation, first five seals, going on now. But remember, this is a telescopic approach. He's reminding John of everything that's going to happen until his return. He hasn't told John everything yet, but he will. Because when that first angel sounds his trumpet, then we start to see those judgments escalate and would lead to that great time of tribulation that will ultimately lead to the tribes of the earth mourning before God because of his return. So we will look at those other thoughts next week. But that's kind of how I approach it.